It's the other one.
And Joan Fenton, Jody Stecker, Tracy Schwartz, and of course everyone knows Dewey Balfa. I'd like to introduce one of the students who's going to be teaching knife making next week, Wild Bill Caldwell. And I'm going to start with them and then introduce several other people and ask some other people to comment. So I'd like to start off by asking Sparky, who began the singing class this afternoon or this evening, to talk a little bit about about the roots of black music and where the music that came from Africa began to develop into American music. How did that happen? Where did it start?
Well, it's interesting in terms of African music and the kinds of things that have happened. First off, a lot of people have theories even about some of the instruments that aren't traditionally thought of as coming from Africa, like the bagpipe, which there are some tracings of the bagpipe from Hannibal into Italy, and the Romans taking the bagpipe from Italy into the British Isles, and then the bagpipe coming from the British Isles to here. And then at the same time, you've got from another part of Africa, from the Savannah coast, the banjo in its form of having a drone string, which is the short string. You know, it was a four-stringed instrument, three and four-stringed instrument. The fifth string, which most people think is the short string, which is not, but it's the bass string that was added by a fellow named Sweeney, who was a favorite of Jeb Stuart. He used to ride around with Jeb Stuart. When Jeb Stuart rode into battle, he brought a bones player and a banjo player with him. He said, "Oh, we're going to have war. It's all fun, too," you know. And all of a sudden, this banjo and the styles from Britain that got influenced through those things meet again in the mountains. One coming up through the south, the other coming in through the New England and down into the mountains, and meeting together again. And these instruments play very well together in lots of music. But in terms of just strictly black music, it had to change. Most people brought their music intact from the old countries. But black people, when they came to this country through slavery, were forced to forget their language, forced to forget their culture, forced to forget the instruments that they were used to playing for the most part. And so they had to totally reinvent the music here in this country. And it has had several interesting grandchildren, including jazz, country music, bluegrass, have all had some roots in blues music. In fact, Bill Monroe, who some people call the father of bluegrass, of course, you know, they used to say mother's baby, father's maybe. But he said, "You know, that's where we got that there bluegrass from your people. You know, if you listen to it, it's the same stuff. You just slow it down a little bit, it becomes blue. Some of the same songs, same changes." So as you say, there is no real pure music anymore, because it's all had such an influence from everybody else. And that is one thing that does make this country so unique, is that we do have people from all cultures who've contributed their music to the music that comes out as being American music. And I can speak on this at length, but we will pass it on.
Let's skip around a little bit. Dewey Balfa, of course, as everybody knows, is the name that everyone thinks of when you think of Cajun music. And the person who's probably responsible, ultimately, for most of us here having been exposed to Cajun music, first introduced it to the rest of the world in a big way at the Newport Folk Festival. When was that, Dewey?
Oh, that was 1964.
Yeah.
I hardly know anything other than I'm a Cajun and I play this music. But then I think back and I think of the people that settled in my area in the southwestern part of Louisiana. There were the Acadians, the descent of French people. There were the Italians, there were the Germans, there were many different nationalities that settled into this area and was very, very isolated for many years. And there's a certain culture that developed among these people, their food, their music, and as it was said before, that there's no pure music. The music that we French descent play is not from Brittany, it's not from Normandy, it's not from the Poitou, it's not from La Vendée, but it's a music that left with these people many, many years ago and settled in Southwest Louisiana and has developed the so-known called Cajun music. But it's not a pure music. It has black music and Italian and German and whatnot.
I so happened
to be sort of drafted into this thing, into the movement of the revival of American folk life without even knowing what I was getting into. And I got into it, and I got involved, and I got sparked, and it's been 25 years. I'm still barking like a little dog in the yard. I don't know what I'm barking at, but I'm still barking. And it's beautiful to see musics of different regions that are brought together, such as Augusta and other folk festivals that are happening around this country, around the world. It brings us together, and only together we stand.
Amen.
I asked Jay Segal if he'd say a few words, I haven't gotten down here yet. So I think that it's interesting because we are here, but one of the reasons that we did Blues Week and Cajun Week together this year is because last year, we thought that there were so many people playing blues who've never been exposed to Zydeco music, which seems so much a combination of the two. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about the similarities and the differences,
Well, the similarity as I see it, as I was brought up, is that the so-called Zydeco music, most folks believes that or has in mind that when they hear Zydeco is Cajun, or when they hear Cajun is Zydeco. It's not so, because when you hear Zydeco, it's music of the black people, their respective way of playing the music from their heart. And believe me, they played from their heart. They played, but they may use an accordion, they may use a guitar, they may use a drum, a rub board, but you never see a fiddle in a Zydeco band. Or vice versa, when you see a Cajun band, you use an accordion, a guitar, drum, and a fiddle, but you never see a rub board. And that's an indication of two different culture in the same area. That is the same culture. We are of the same area. We're of the same culture, but then there's an identity as you are a girl, I'm a boy.
Okay. Jody Stecker is one of the people that people think of in connection with so much of the real early revival of folk music, and he's been involved for many, many years, as has Tracy Schwartz, in being a person who's helped people find out about music that came before them and to sort of synthesize it. And maybe you could talk a little bit about these things that people think of as separate areas: country music, bluegrass music, folk music. Is it all very, very separate?
think you're saying it well enough yourself. I think that if you look beneath the surface of any well-known musician who's well-known for what they do, such and such a blues musician, such and such a Cajun musician, such and such a bluegrass musician, whatever it is, 90% of the time you'll find their interests are very wide. They appreciate, probably are closet players of something else. The blues man is not supposed to like country music in the popular image, but it's not really so. The bluegrass musician might be listening to music from Ireland. You never can tell, but I always have found that to be true, that
how would you
musicians are not, musicians anywhere are not as narrow-minded as their fans are, as they must be.
We shouldn't say that.
Yeah, you got the Tom Jones singing Prince songs.
So you would try to define bluegrass, for example, to somebody who didn't know what you were talking about.
I could define bluegrass. I'd say it's stylized black string band music played by white people. It's.
Can you say that
louder? I said it's stylized black string band music played by white people. A lot of it, anyway. It's very, very, it's almost classical music at this point. The roles are so clearly defined. What's bluegrass and what isn't? If you take one left turn, it's not bluegrass anymore. It might be better or worse, but it's gotten very, very defined. I almost call it classical now. All you got to do is listen, though.
All right.
Jenna? Yeah.
I did a lot of field research in West Virginia, and I was doing primarily research for public radio to do a series of shows.
A little louder.
Okay, can I move that?
No, that's not amplified.
Oh, it's not. It looks good. Okay. I was doing a lot of field research in West Virginia. I was doing it for public radio, and I was looking at different types of music. I would go into a home and ask somebody to play for me, but I only played blues, okay? So at first I'd feel like, well, you know, I don't really want to play my kind of music. And after a while somebody'd say, well, you play a tune. Well, I would bring out the guitar and I'd play a blues tune. Invariably, every white musician that I ever met in West Virginia played a blues tune, okay? And we're talking somebody 60, 70, 80 years old who you would have thought just played that style. You know, okay, you may think that in the revival we were all eclectic and listened to everything, but back then, if you were a good musician and somebody came by that was a good musician or somebody had a record that was a great record, it didn't matter what style it was. Now, what would happen is, like, I recorded one fiddler who took a Bessie Smith's tune and made it a fiddle tune, okay? He couldn't play a blues. But his son took another blues tune and played it as a blues tune in E. It was the only tune he ever played in E, but he played it as a blues tune. I met two banjo players in Mill Creek who were, they must have been in their 70s, and they played Hesitation Blues, okay? And they giggled and they laughed, but they knew that tune. And every place and every house I ever went into, they knew that blues somehow. Somebody had come through. And what you find a lot in this state is particularly in the railroads or in the mining areas. If somebody came in that was a good musician, you'd listen to them. And there's a lot of cross-influence, what Sparky was talking about before. If you go to the West Indies, you'll find much more of an African sound where there was much less white influence. There were much heavier populations of slaves, much less white back and forth influence. But here, you'll always, always find that cross influence. And you know, I was very naive at the time. I thought, you know, they don't want to hear my blues. And as I would do this every time, it was like it always brought this incredible response, and it was always very, very positive. And you really get to see from doing that. And also on record, particularly with the Jimmy Rogers records, every blues musician listened to Jimmy Rogers.
you'll meet a lot of blues musicians that listen to country western. And I was working with a man in North Carolina, and he was doing all these Ernest Tubb tunes on guitar, but he was playing them as blues tunes, and it was great, you know.
I'd like to add something, something to that. In fact, a lot of instances. But basically, you talk about Jimmie Rodgers and Hank Williams also, both attributed quite a lot of their influence from black musicians. And of course, you talk to John Jackson, he talks about the Jimmie Rodgers and Uncle Dave Macon songs that he learned. Of course, Uncle Dave Macon learned them from black musicians, so that, you know, there's a lot of swapping. Quite often, when I first started playing, I did most of the festivals that I played were in Kentucky, North Carolina, Virginia, West Virginia. And generally, I'd be the only black person there. Being brave as I am and whatnot, that was no problem with that. But there was always, always a musician would come to me to tell me about this black fiddle player that taught them how to play fiddle, or this black banjo player that taught them the first songs that they had learned. And I'm sure if people who do the research would talk to some of the black musicians, they'd tell them there's some white person that taught them some things. There's never been any thing of like, well, I can't play that song because that's a white person or a black person. You say, oh, he's a good musician. Let me learn that mm-hmm. lick. that's one of the horrible things that Child did when he came here, besides the fact he never even cared about the music anyway as much as he did about the verses.
Yeah.
But he neglected to do his research fully in terms of talking to the black population about the ballad tradition from there. He also didn't talk to people about the cross-culturalization. It's like folklorists always are so narrow-minded. They're always out to prove their point that they missed the niche. If you listen to people like Doc Boggs and Roscoe Holcomb, mm-hmm. when you listen to Doc Boggs, you're listening to his versions on a banjo of him singing blues tunes that he learned from black women who were piano players. I mean, so, you know, there is no pure music. It's all good music.
What is blues music? Blues music is Cajun music. Blues music is black people's music. Blues music is bluegrass music. Mm-hmm. Blues music is music of the hard times of our forefathers of this country.
Precisely.
That's what it is.
Very uniquely American, isn't it?
Tracy?
Well, I agree with everything everybody said. I just want to underline it by saying it's amazing. You can't dictate what people are going to like, and you cannot tell them what they can't like and what they can't play. If a certain kind of music speaks to them, they're going to play it. And we've been, you know, many, many, many examples of this going on. In my own personal case, it was radio. I think radio has had a lot to do with it, too. Radio and records has stirred it up quite a bit. That the process was going on anyway, but in a lot of times when roads were nothing more than like a cow path, and took all day to go 30 miles, well, when the records came in, or radio, that really started stirring things up. But it was still the same process that was going to happen sooner or later. So no matter what anybody says, we're going to mix it up.
Uh-huh. Well, make then, a jambalaya.
You grew up listening to the radio in northern Louisiana and were around and knew a lot of the people who were involved in the early days of rock and roll, and which really developed out of this country music. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that happened? What was that like?
Well, you know, say in the real early 50s, you were around North Louisiana. Another thing, what you people up here call blues is not what we would call blues around Louisiana, Mississippi, Nashville. It would be more of a finger-picking style of guitar. Blues to us is Muddy Waters, Jimmy Reed, those sort of people. But going on, he had Hank Williams doing his music, and a real, real simple kind of music. Real good words, really hit you hard. Then on the other extreme, you had Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. That the music they played was, you had to be a super good musician to play it well. It was Western swing, but you had to be the equivalent of a real good progressive jazz musician to play it.
then though, I guess there was some of us, like Jerry Lee, some of those guys, that there was always something missing. There was something that just didn't fill up the hole. Then along comes Elvis doing That's Right, Mama, Jerry Lee doing Crazy Arms, that sort of thing, and you know that that was what it took. That was it. So that's, you know, the rockabilly, or the early, what I guess a lot of people call rock and roll, that to those of us that played it was rockabilly.
Do you see that coming directly from the blues tradition?
No. I would think it came more from the Assembly of God churches.
So it was basically saying the same thing, if you think of it.
well, I don't know. You could take, like, the gospel music that, say, the Baptists play. I'd almost have to take a guitar and show you, but...
Do you have one handy?
Well, I really didn't want to do this, but...
yeah.
Yeah.
Since he's not here this week as a musician, I'll, and just further my introduction, say that Bill used to play with Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins and a few other people who were around in the early days of rockabilly.
I guess... take, going back to where I think it came from, like if you were in a Baptist church and you did this gospel song, it would be like, when my soul is singing in the presence of the Lord, I'll be satisfied. Yeah, it don't have a lot of drive to it or anything like that. So then along comes Jerry Lee. Elvis did the same thing, I know, because he has an ain't that was an Assembly of God preacher. So a lot of people think that maybe Memphis was the birthplace of rockabilly music, and it's not really so. The only way that Memphis even got in on the act was because they had Sun Record Company, a little bitty small record company. Sam Phillips ran the thing, and he just lucked into recording Elvis and Jerry Lee and some of the others to get it started. It almost got started down at Crowley, Louisiana. Guy, I'm sure Dewey knows, Jay Miller.
Very well.
Wouldn't record Jerry Lee Lewis. Jerry Lee went to Memphis, and Sam Phillips snapped him up. So anyway, Jerry Lee and them would do the same song like...
The reason I said what I said, Bill, see, I grew up in the Church of God, which in the Black Church of God, or Sanctified Church, you know, they keep splitting them off and splitting them off. My grandfather was a bishop in the Church of God and whatnot. We sing that song the same way. And people like Ida Cox, who some of you are into classic blues, went to my grandfather's church. And they, when she started singing the blues, instead of singing the gospel songs, they kicked her out of the church. Same way Jerry Lee's cousin would want it to have done. So that's what I was saying in terms of, like, they seem to all have come out of the church, some of those same kinds of rhythms and whatnot. And the Southern fundamentalist churches tended to have that more of a rockin' rhythm, you know, and people tapping their foot and patting their hands and really moving
done
it.
That particular.
That song we sing in my church every Sunday. that was why I was saying, you know, when you said Assembly of God, I thought, yeah, I can deal with that.
Yeah.
On HBO, they were running a special, which were the outtakes. What they would do for this television show, there was a sequence where Elvis would be out on a platform in the middle of the audience.
And people sitting
there. He knew a song. he'd have his group around with him, and they'd do the song. In order to get that one song for the TV show, they would tape an hour of all kinds of things happening. And he would sing three or four different songs, and then they would decide which one he'd want to keep. I just remember watching this thing, and they did an Elvis song, one of his hits. And at one point, he said, Elvis said, well, let's do something different. Elvis said, let me play guitar. Took the guitar, and he started doing a Jimmy Reed, bum 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 bum. And he did, baby, what you want me to do? But we're all concerned. Yeah, you got me.
Or at least communist.
Well, Sam Phillips had always said before Elvis came along that if he could find a white boy that could sing like some of the black musicians there, that he'd make $1 million.
That's what happened. Essentially, what Elvis and Jerry Lee and these people were copying. Imitating, copying. They were
interpreters.
The popular black music, and it was suddenly respected.
Well, Big Boy Crudup did That's All Right Mama, but Elvis probably had, I think, a better version of it, especially with, you know, Scotty Moore on lead guitar and what all, Bill Black on bass. It added a lot to it. I think those guys just had so much talent that, you know, I mean, you can call yourself a musician, but if you're a piano player and you ever watch Jerry Lee, you know, there's just one Jerry. He'll tell you in a minute, Mickey Gillie and Jimmy Swaggart are good musicians, but he has the talent. And, you know, he's not, you know, you think, well, the guy's conceited or it's an ego trip, but it's not, it's really not. Jerry Lee just is that good. He knows how good he is. He goes in a studio, and if you've ever been to Nashville or anything like that, there's all sorts of overdubbing, and oh, you keep doing it and doing it and doing it. Jerry Lee goes in, sits down at the piano, does it in one take. Crazy Arms was done in one take. Whole lot of shaking, one take. They may do it a time or two later just to see what it would sound like with a different guitar lick or something like that. But basically, you know, he has that kind of talent. Elvis did too.
In fact, if you keep repeating it, you might lose that spark that you had when you first played it, because, you know, the heart was there at first.
And some, you know, various influences. I mean, these guys didn't even know that they were playing rock and roll. I mean, Fats Domino, these guys are all senior citizens now. I mean, Fats, New Orleans, playing New Orleans funk or, you know, and blues. And Chuck Berry going up to Chicago, and he admits in his book that he stole all those, to say, Chuck Berry introductions. I mean, he got a lot of those from the Chicago blues guys and Elvis. Buddy Holly was a guy out of Texas. And so it seems to me that it's just about, like, you know, what you're talking about, this amalgam of early American music, because there is no one spot where rock came from. Early rock is just a hodgepodge of sounds from all over the place. And there was no one, you know. Probably a whole lot of people in history, either directly or indirectly, too.
nice and loud.
Yeah.
Well, I have to think first. The new lost who? I was thinking in each case, it was slightly different in each case, but I think records had a heck of a lot to do with it in the beginning. Well, with Mike Seeger's case, his family was collecting folk music from, you know, way back. John Cohen's case, his family was into folk dancing and collecting records too. If there were any one source, I think it would be records. They certainly made it possible for the Ramblers to do something that people in other countries couldn't do. I've heard that said. Said, well, look, you Americans had this advantage. You had all those recordings. And it's interesting, Sparky alluded to it already, the scholarly folklore scholars were missing out on what the capitalists were cashing in on. It was the impetus of the dollar which gave us all of these records. And it's an incredible documentary of what was going on. And anybody could buy them, so they spread all around and really got things going, and it got the New Lost City Ramblers going too. And various little things, personal experiences and so on too. So we, well, it's mostly Mike and John, I would say, did a lot of visiting record collectors, and they weren't stingy at all. They would open they would open up what was left of their houses. Usually had stacks in it. You had to kind of edge sideways through the stacks, you know, find a chair there, you know, and it'd be all.